Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Wesley Lloyd from Fort Worth. He is with the firm of Freeman Mills. Wesley, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm a fan.
If you would. Well, thank you.
We appreciate it. We're glad you're here.
That's right. If you would, tell our guests a little bit about yourself, your practice, and where you come from.
All right. Originally from a small town out in West Texas, and mainly grew up in Austin. Went to A&M for undergrad and Tech for law school, and through a circuitous meandering route, ended up practicing oil and gas primarily, and now even more limited than that in litigation and appeals, both trial work and appeals, and try to focus on that and provide value to clients in that industry. So you say I'm from Fort Worth. My office is in Fort Worth, but I work remote almost 95%+ of the time. Spend kind of split time between Central Texas and West Texas.
Okay. So were you doing that before the pandemic, or is that kind of a recent development?
Yeah, I was remote before it was cool, right? before COVID made it necessary and all that. Yeah, I was for the past 6 years, I guess I've been working remote and enjoyed it. It has its pros and cons, of course, but overall, I like it a lot.
So how did you find your way to an oil and gas practice? Did you know that's what you wanted to do coming out of law school, or?
No, not at all. Again, it's kind of a meandering road and a series of fortuitous events or coincidences. But in undergrad, I took, class. I don't know. Back then, this was in probably 99 or 2000, and I'm looking to go to law school. So we're, focused on all of us who were thinking about that back then. We're trying to figure out how to get our GPA up, right? To get in where we want, get a scholarship, whatever. And, back then we had a website called Pick a Prof, if y'all remember that. And it was a new thing. And I looked, there was a class, oil and gas law for undergrads, which was interesting. And I don't think it's even taught anymore, but the grades in that class were not good. He gave like 1A a semester. So I said, I'm not going to take that, even though I was interested in it, trying to get my GPA up for law school. It ended up being a good fit and kind of I needed to take it in that slot. I worked full-time in undergrad, put myself through, so I didn't have as much flexibility on when I would schedule classes, and it ended up being a great fit. And I loved it and loved the professor and have kept in touch with him ever since. But throughout my story, mentoring is a big part of my story. There's a lot of great people who have given their time to me in the past. And I wouldn't be what I am. If I'm anything, I wouldn't be that without those people. So that professor, Judon Fambro at A&M at the Texas Real Estate Center, great guy. Anyway, I took it and loved it. And I ended up getting that A in the class that semester. So it was one of those situations where I'm glad I took the risk and did it. But anyway, I went on to law school, and I wanted to do water law and then maybe environmental. Right. And that was what I focused on all through law school. I had no plans to practice oil and gas. Then, I remember distinctly a conversation. I was sitting at my grandmother's house and she had a friend over while I was in law school. And they asked me what I was going to practice, what kind of law I was going to practice. And my grandmother answered for me and she said, oil and gas law. And I looked at her like she was crazy, and it turns out she was right. But I think she was lucky more than anything. But so then when I got out of law school, I went to a big-ish law firm and was doing environmental and water. And there became a need for a associate to help with oil and gas stuff, as the Barnett Shale was really active and natural gas prices were really high. It was really active. And so I got into started doing that, you know, just as kind of survival as a young associate. The firm, you know, senior partner comes to you and says, we need you to, you know, bone up on this stuff and help, you know, this lawyer. I had another mentor at that firm who was board certified in oil and gas. And he wrote and graded the bar exam. He was on the board of law examiners, you know, did the bar exam question on oil and gas, and was a great mentor to me too. And so gradually over time, it just became a bigger and bigger.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, litigation analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages, from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge.
You know, share of my practice, and I started to really enjoy it and started litigating some oil and gas disputes, and eventually it became over half of my practice at that point. And then I decided to get board certified in it and somehow pass the exam. And ever since then, that's what I've been doing. And I eventually got away from the transactional work, and because I just realized I was better at litigation and appeals because I enjoyed those more. Now I represent oil companies and some surface owners, some royalty owners, mostly defending oil and gas companies, though.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedeas bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond, ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a billion-dollar appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
I'm trying to imagine how different that must be today versus how it was, you know, 100 plus years ago, when a lot of these deeds were that you learn about. If you take oil and gas in law school, I actually did take it in law school and enjoyed it. And but they weren't the model of clarity, I would say. And so has there been a push in the transactional side of oil and gas to really kind of clean up how the transactions are done to try to make things clearer?
I feel bad for the transactional guys and girls. You know, Supreme Court precedent can change things and has in recent years, that, you know, everybody thinks that litigation is more stressful than transactional work. And I didn't find that to be the case at all. You know, in litigation, at least I know what your argument is now, right? And in transactions, I'm trying to imagine what the arguments are going to be later. And those kind of things are what kept me up at night. So I find litigation, believe it or not, I find litigation to be a lot less stressful. So yeah, our Supreme Court takes a lot of oil and gas cases. They realize appropriately and accurately that other states look to the Texas Supreme Court for guidance on oil and gas issues. And the Supreme Court takes that responsibility very seriously. It appears, it's apparent, right, based on what they take and what they write on, and, you know, just the number of cases, that's obvious. But I also know that from talking to different Supreme Court justices about how seriously they take that, because it's almost like they are the Supreme Court of the United States when it comes to oil and gas law, in a way.
Well, it's a very important industry in our state, and I know it's changing to some degree. We've had push for alternative energy, and because that's always going to be the case, that there's going to be other new energy sources coming up. But, you know, Texas is an oil rich state, and you mentioned the Barnett Shale. There's been some major gas, oil and gas developments coming out of those large formations for a long time. And it's hard to imagine that changing anytime real soon. You know, what is coming at it from your perspective today? What do you see being the wave of the future in the industry? Do you think we're going to have any issues with oil and gas going forward? That's not a good question. Let me try to come at that another way. So the industry is changing. What are some of the issues that oil and gas lawyers are seeing at the forefront in these times?
Yeah, the industry is changing. The law changes too a little bit over time, and that makes it important to stay up to speed and keep on your toes. So I make an effort to. I've signed up to do the case law update for the general practice section on oil and gas law to force myself to stay up to speed on those new cases. The industry, obviously, every time there's a new party in office in DC, a new president, that has some impact regulatory wise, not so much on Texas, a little bit on Texas, but there's most of Texas being private property. The feds are not going to be able to, regulate what's happening on private property so much unless it comes to like air emissions and things like that. But that's an interesting aspect. Even though I could, and even though I have in the past done some of that, I don't do much of that at all right now. But yeah, there is regulatory pressure. There's politics involved, which are interesting to me and that I like to follow. So that all makes it a very interesting area to work in. As far as, did you ask about trends in litigation going forward, or?
Well, not so much specifically trends in litigation. I'm just thinking about the industry from a broader perspective. Like, we see a lot more alternative fuels. You can't drive through parts of West Texas, and I've seen these in other states, without seeing the big giant wind turbines. And I'm just wondering what we're seeing in terms of how the law is responding to those alternative, or the industry rather is responding to those alternative energy sources.
Right. Well, I think there's some common misconceptions out there. And for any young lawyers or law students who listen to your podcast, I would say there's two pretty common misconceptions. One goes to the heart of your question, and that is that the oil and gas industry is going to go away, or, that there won't be a demand for oil and gas lawyers in the future as students or young lawyers are planning their career, that they may want to stay away from oil and gas. I don't subscribe to that theory at all. In fact, I disagree with it completely, because the efficiency of oil and gas for energy generation is not going to be something that's easily replaced. And I'm a proponent of having wind power, having solar, and even nuclear, as a matter of fact, maybe in my mind, as a practical matter, is if you wanted to replace oil and gas, that's the way you would go. But you can, from 1 gallon of gas, people don't realize this, 1 gallon of gas kicks out enough energy, right? Bundled in that gallon is enough energy to recharge your iPhone every day for the next 20 years.
Wow.
Okay. It's equivalent to 1.5 gallons of ethanol, 1.5 gallons of LNG, 33.4 kilowatt hours of electricity. That's a power-packed, efficient energy source, right? And I just don't think you can replace that. When you get in your car and head down, for y'all, it's I-10, right? Speed limit's 85 now, isn't it? out west of San Antonio, and gas weighs about 6 pounds a gallon. That gallon of gas weighs about 6 pounds, and if you think about burning that in your engine and it hurtling a 5,000-pound vehicle at 85 miles an hour, that's amazing, And that's going to get that gallon is going to carry you 20-25. If you're energy efficient, obviously the weight is going. I mean, if you're in a smaller vehicle. But anyway, my point is that's not easy to replace. Electric, is good and getting better, but I just don't see the demand for oil and gas going away. And, it's kind of like when the people, deans or law professors, say it's not so important to go learn to track a case because trials are going away, right? Well, trials are going away, but the fact is, you don't know how to try a case, and the other side doesn't know you're willing to go try a case and that you can and will win or preserve errors on appeal or whatever, that impacts your settlement. And so the fact that settlement is more common makes it more important that the leverage you have in settlement is going to trial, right? Those two misconceptions. I don't see oil and gas going away, and I don't agree with the premise that young lawyers shouldn't learn to try a case, you know?
Well, take us through what an oil and gas case looks like, you know, from the beginning. I assume most of the time what we're talking about, maybe not most, but at least some of the time what we're talking about is disputes over royalties. But what other kinds of disputes can come up as an oil and gas litigator?
Well, there's a ton. It's got its own broad topic of oil and gas litigation, but there are a ton of niche specialties within that itself too. I have in the past litigated and have a lot of experience with like surface disputes where minerals have been severed. Surface owner doesn't own any minerals. Of course, they don't like having an oil and gas company come drill a well, put a road in, put a power line in, or, you know, whatever the case may be. And that spills over onto, you know, bigger, commercial operations like solar farms. You know, the conflict between a solar farm and an oil and gas operator who's got the minerals leased, and, sand and gravel operations, things, water reservoirs, things that consume a large surface area when, you know, historic in Texas, the policy is that minerals are the, dominant estate. It doesn't mean that it's like the superior, but, you know, if push comes to shove, the oil and gas operator is going to have the right to go on and drill a well, because otherwise the minerals wouldn't be worth anything, right? Those kind of conflicts, that's one subset that that I've done a lot of work in. Yeah, royalty disputes, you know, that's always going to be an issue. And then that gets into, you know, what does the lease say? If the lease is not clear on that, what's the common law? What has the Supreme Court said about it? Those disputes, there are lawyers out there who just do those kind of cases. And then you get into, you know, fiduciary duty stuff, joint operating agreements. And the industry is so capital intensive, it requires so much money. It necessitates the need for partnership to go, you know, complete projects. And anytime you got that, you've got potential disputes. And then factor in prices, you know, as prices go down and revenues shrink, you've got service companies that have been working on things that find it hard to get paid. Then there's collections issues, liens. There's a whole separate section of the property code that deals with mineral liens as opposed to contractors, you know, mechanics liens, all of those things, man. Securities, people who like securities ought to pay attention to the oil and gas industry. Financing. I mean, the transactional stuff is mesmerizing in that area a lot. So there's a lot of little subsets within what you would term oil and gas litigation. But I think you're right. Traditionally, you're going to think of royalty disputes. Oh, one big one. You mentioned earlier that the drafting had changed over time, and you know, the old documents. That's a big source of litigation right now, because you know, deeds signed back in the early 1900s that say things that are not clear, and that, you know, and then there's a Supreme Court case a little while back that unintentionally probably has created even more litigation on that, because you got to go kind of case by case by the deed. And so those kind of disputes are the most common, I would guess, but they're all interesting. They're also all the kind of thing that somebody could specialize in if they wanted to.
You know, one thing that comes into my mind in oil and gas litigation is it's almost like you're speaking another language. And if you have a trial judge that maybe is not oil and gas familiar, or jurors, how do you explain some of these kind of arcane language and concepts in a way that gets across to judges and jurors that are not at all familiar with this whole world and whole world of vocabulary?
Right. Yeah. I have a case right now over seismic data. And the terminology has been, I've had a learning curve in that. One thing I really like about oil and gas litigation is it's fascinating. The technology, the R&D that goes in is, I mean, there may be other industries that do more R&D, you know, and engineering technology that develop more, but I don't know, man, maybe Silicon Valley. But the people who are active in this industry do amazing things. And that's one thing I really enjoy, is learning about it as you go forward. So as I learn, you're exactly right. I have to figure out how to convey what, you know, this completely foreign language of what a seismic, you know, acquisition does, how it works. You know, people, lay people will be shocked to know it's even possible, right? Or that a petroleum engineer, you know, can take a drill bit, you know, the size of a lunchbox and put it in the bed of a pickup truck 4 miles away underground. Amazing, right? How do they do that? I try to just break it down to, you know, or the money aspect, the way that these deals are structured, or the what you're trading off. I try to break it down in ways the judge, you know, if a summary judgment case, the way that the judge would understand it, you know, or the way that a landowner would understand it, you know, put it on a city lot instead of a 70,000 acre ranch at issue, put it on a 7/10 of an acre residential lot, you know, and say, if your neighbor wanted to put a electric line across the middle of your property, you know, what concerns would you have, and get them thinking in that, reduce it down. It to answer that question, it really depends on what we're talking about. But yeah, it is a, now it depends on where you're at also, you know, venue for oil and gas is usually in places that are active in oil and gas. So on the jury, we're going to get people who are familiar with it, people who work in the industry, and people who realize the importance of it, so to speak. Sometimes we get into federal court, especially, and you'll be removed from that local, you know, you don't have that intensity of experience on the jury, and the judges may not, you know, there are certain counties in West Texas, especially right now, where the district court judge is a bona fide expert on oil and gas. Those cases go to either the Eastland Court of Appeals. Usually Eastland decides an incredible number of oil and gas cases and have become pretty very reliable in what they say on that. El Paso does too, to an extent, but not as much as Eastland. And, or I don't know, I'm spitballing there. I may be off base, but, and then the attention that the Supreme Court pays too, you know? So, yeah, I mean, if I'm in a court where the judge does not have experience with oil and gas, we take a different approach and try to break it down into more common terms. You know, we talk about hiring a plumbing contractor instead of hiring a water hauler, right? Mm-hmm.
So it just, even down to the basic terminology, it sounds like you're having to adjust sometimes depending on where you are.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I know that we have a special volume of the pattern jury charges that is focused on oil and gas. And before you kind of gave that explanation about how you go about presenting an oil and gas case to a court or even a jury, that makes perfect sense that your jury pools would be different, maybe sophisticated and more than the general population in terms of the industry, if you're in an area where that's a large part of what people do. But I don't know a thing about the oil and gas volume of the PJCs. Do you find those helpful when you're preparing a case for trial? And do they adjust for that sort of common language, or do you have to kind of go around some of the terminology in the PJCs?
Now, I don't think that the PJCs you're talking about are officially sanctioned state bar PJCs yet. The oil and gas section of the state bar developed those. They may be now. I may be mistaken about that.
They are. I'll just tell you, they're actually a book now that's oil and gas.
Okay.
So, but if it's, I'm sure it was developed with input from members, if not the actual organization, the oil and gas section of the State Bar of Texas. But
yeah, that would be a recent development for them to be official, you know, state bar pattern jury charges, because I want to say 5 years ago, that would have probably been within the last 5 years, because the section did those in an unofficial capacity as a service to the membership of that section of the state bar for a long time. And so I'm sure, and they were good, very good by experts, you know, legends of oil and gas law in Texas that took it very seriously and did a good job on them. So those, they do deal in different terms. They do cite cases that are oil and gas, you know, exclusively. And then you got to bring in normal or the more broad common stuff that everybody knows about with contract issues, with injunctive relief, with, you know, trespass claim, causes of action, things like that, that are more common. So, but I'm glad to know it's official now. Mm-hmm. I haven't needed to go find any new ones recently. So I guess I got to pay for that now.
That's right.
And I'm sure the firm has them already. I'm joking, but.
So, I mean, you try cases as a trial lawyer in this practice area, but you handle appeals as well. Is that right?
That's right. I try to be, I think of it as vertically integrated, but not the jack of all trades, because I do believe that that means you're the master of none. But I believe it is very important for a trial lawyer to understand the appellate, you know, what's going to happen on appeal and how to be sure that it's all preserved. And I think the best way to do that is to have to do some appeals. That does not mean there is definitely a role and a value in a dedicated appellate specialist. And I 100%, you know, agree with that. For my practice, I don't handle all the appeals. I will send those out, you know, to specialists, and I'll take appeals, you know, of cases I didn't try, but I like to handle them, you know, to keep myself well-rounded and I enjoy it. I mean, that's not a proper motivating factor a lot of times for a lawyer to do stuff they like, you know. They need to provide value to the clients and be sure that it's stuff that they're really good at. And if I feel like it's a case where either I don't have familiarity with the court that it's going to, or it's an important enough issue for the client that, you know, that we need a Supreme Court specialist who, you know, who sees those judges at dinner, you know, in Austin, then I'll send those out. But I try to stay involved where I can, where it's appropriate for the client. Yes.
It seems like maybe more in oil and gas cases than any other that it's potentially ripe for amicus support, because there's so many little ripples in the industry that you may not foresee, you know, from a particular provision in the lease. I feel like we see them a lot more in oil and gas cases than in other places. Is that just me imagining that, or is that right?
You know, you would be a better judge of whether or not it's more common in these appeals, because these appeals are really the only ones I'm looking at. But it is common. The trade associations pay careful attention. There are some royalty owner groups that pay close attention. There are surface owner groups, you know, hunting, ranching groups and things like that, mm-hmm. that pay close attention to these issues and will weigh in. Farm Bureau, you know, to the cattle raisers, and to anybody listening who paying attention, all of that means there's political consequences involved. They're active in lobbying, they are active in fundraising and all that. So it, yes, the amicus work is common. It's important. I think, I believe, I mean, I would like to know, I would like to visit with Supreme Court justice off the record sometime and say, you know, how much do you pay attention to who's weighing in or what they're saying and things like that? I mean, I think they're obviously doing it, and I don't think they're going to give undue weight to it, but also, you know, amicus industry associations and, you know, stakeholder groups that weigh in have a perspective that may not have been considered by these specific parties or the impact beyond this specific case, you know? So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I've done amicus work and I've enjoyed it immensely, because it allows a lawyer to step back and think about policy, which I'm a policy kind of thinker anyway. So it's a good fit for me, but also get the industry perspective and, you know, and weigh in and say, here's what you may not be thinking about, or here's why it ought to go this way. And I think there's a lot of potential for young lawyers to get experience there if they wanted to, by offer to do it for free, you know, mm-hmm. a time or two and do good work in the job you're doing, and maybe it'll lead to something else later. So yeah, amicus is very important in the oil and gas industry.
For people that want to kind of get into oil and gas work, do you have any tips on ways that a young lawyer can kind of make contacts in industry or industry groups and sort of find their path in that way?
Yeah, it may take them out of their comfort zone, but call people, send them an email. Figure out who does what and where, you know, and good fit. Find a common connection. If you undergrad, fraternity, law school, you know, something, latch onto to make that person. You know, generally, I think people are hesitant to do that because they think they're going to take up people's time and that people don't want to hassle with it. And certainly, that's a legitimate concern that. So I don't mean to delegitimize that, but I think they would be surprised how often people are willing to help and to talk about you know, their experience. And it's a compliment to people to be asked, is what I would tell anybody who's wanting to do it. Don't be afraid to go ask for help. You know, you may get, you know, you may get a helpful response from one out of three. Is probably what I would suspect. That's a pretty good hit rate, you know, and go about it that way. You know, that's not even specific to the oil and gas industry though. You know, that's just general advice. So I don't think there's anything I would say that changes the general rule. You know, a lot of oil and gas practice, you know, the litigation practice anyway, ends up being in smaller towns, West Texas, you know, East Texas, South Texas. And, you know, if someone wanted to do that, they could locate to those places. It's not necessary, but it's helpful, right, to be there sometimes. I mean, it depends on what you want to do. If you want to represent.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com.
Represent the landowners and the mineral owners, you might want to be there. If you want to represent the companies and all that, you may want to be in the town where the city where those companies are located and build those relationships. I would also suggest they, you know, attend CLE conferences. You know, this again is kind of the same as if you wanted to go into administrative law or water or construction or some, you know, real estate. You go meet the people who are there, do the networking thing and talk to the speakers and keep in touch with people. But there's a lot of good trade associations in the oil and gas industry, a lot of good CLE opportunities and professional advancement organizations that, you know, you could be a member of 20 different ones. It's too much to do all of them, but there's ample opportunity out there for someone to grow their network and eventually grow a client base that sustains that practice.
Is the most intelligent legal research tool on the market in your slate of legal technology? Westlaw Edge is powered by the most advanced artificial intelligence available. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to be more efficient and stay competitive by delivering the fastest answers and most valuable insights for a clear strategic advantage. Capitalize on Westlaw Edge's AI features and be confident that you're getting results you can rely on to serve your clients better than before.
Just looked online as we were talking here, and I see that Texas Bar CLE has offered in the past a handling your first or next oil and gas case program. We've talked about those sort of base level programs on the show here recently. Sounds like that one might have been a good one to check out. And I think it's still available. The program is still available, at least online. I wanted to ask, though, you know, we talk on the show all the time about how the appellate bar is pretty tight knit, actually very tight knit, even on a statewide basis. We all tend to know each other. We see each other in cases over and over again. Is that the case with the oil and gas bar? I mean, do you see the same people over and over? And is it a collegial group like we are?
Very, very collegial in my experience. And you know, you don't want to burn a bridge. You know, I tell people all the time, you know, when I got board certified in oil and gas, you know, you have to have 10 references and they can't be in your law firm and they have to be licensed in Texas. And, you know, my biggest client at the time, all the in-house lawyers were located in Oklahoma. They weren't licensed in Texas. And, you know, I had one in-house lawyer who was licensed in Texas who I could use as a reference. The other nine were people I had litigated against. And, you know, pleased to say they all agreed and you know, were references for me. And I think that's a credit to them probably more than me, but I don't try to, I would say it's mostly collegial. You're always going to run into, you know, situations where someone's being more zealous than they have to be, I guess, you know, or taking positions they don't have to take or doing things you don't like, but remaining collegial to me is very important. And as far as running across the same lawyers, I think Yes. I mean, that does happen. The same firms and all that, and kind of get to know, people, but I haven't had it happen just a whole lot in my practice. There's enough oil and gas lawyers to go around that you may not, run across the same ones all the time. And in my experience, a lot of, general practice or general litigation types who do other types of work will dabble into it. I run across lawyers on the other side who have never handled an oil and gas case before and I make it my priority to make sure that they, one, never want to do it again because we, kicked their butt. But two, that, the next time they have something come up, they're going to think of me and send it to me. And, that's a tough, it's a fine line to walk to stay friends with people and try to kick their butt. Right.
Well, that seems really, really dangerous for a general civil litigator to take on an oil and gas case. But I'll say that I know some appellate lawyers who sort of take the same approach when facing a general civil litigator in an appeal, with the exception of, we don't necessarily want to run them over and make them feel worthless, but we definitely want them to call us the next time after they lose to us.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. I've had it happen repeatedly. I've sued companies before that I now represent. Lawyers on the other side call recently and say, can you help us with this? And I take that as a high compliment, and I know y'all do too. So
you absolutely should. I mean, there's really no better feeling in the world than when you get called by a former opposing counsel who's going to refer his client to you to handle something within your area of specialty. I think that goes a long way. I mean, it really illustrates the point about professionalism in our profession and the need for it and how it can really pay off down the line. And
absolutely. Yeah.
One thing I kind of wanted to just touch on generally, and we don't have to go in too much detail. You mentioned working on water law earlier in your career. And now, can you just talk a little bit about that? Because I recognize the concept, but I don't really know kind of the nuances of what that type of practice looks like.
Yeah, I wanted to do that because I knew how important it was going to be for the state. So I figured it would be in demand and it's important. And that's what I was planning to do when I came out of law school was water law. And then the basis for that was knowing how important it was going to be for the state. The scarcity, the population growth, and the developing area of law, I thought it would be in demand. It certainly is. My transition to oil and gas has nothing to do with the status of practicing water law in Texas. It's still super important and sexy. I mean, it very interesting, important policy level work that I would encourage anybody to look into. Now the client base, is more limited and how much you can actually do. There's not the car wreck, it's not like that. Like every day something's happening. You gotta really put thought into where those clients are going to be. But yeah, I love water law. Now I've gotten away from it recently because one big reason being oil and gas stuff just kind of took over my practice, but I was appointed by the governor to serve on the board of the Brazos River Authority back in 2016. And so really can't do any, surface water type of work in the Brazos Basin because it might be, potentially adverse to the interests of the Brazos River Authority. And as the director, fiduciary duty of that organization. So I don't do any surface water work in the Brazos Basin at all. I consult with and help people outside of the basin if it's not going to impact something that we're doing. But to anybody who's interested in that, I would encourage them to look into it and explore. Again, find a mentor who can explain the business realities of it as much as anything. And you've got to be in a firm that's going to do that and find a client base. And, but yeah, I love water law. I just don't get to do much of it.
It seems like in both oil and gas and in water law that there's a layer of administrative law that kicks up from time to time. And I think you mentioned that maybe early on in the conversation about administrative work. So I guess that's the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality is one agency that comes to mind. Are there others? And what do you have to say about the administrative aspects of what you do?
Yeah, I mean, in oil and gas, I think, you know, there are a handful of lawyers in Austin who have developed a really good, you know, railroad commission practice, and they're the go-to people. It's probably difficult for someone outside of Austin to kind of break into that. I mean, it happens, and it's kind of a client by client thing. But yeah, you've got the railroad commission, you've got TCEQ, and there's some overlap between TCEQ and railroad commission about how they regulate, like the environmental, you know, aspects of the industry. Then you've got, you know, potential federal involvement from EPA and, you know, air stuff, you know, to worry about. And then if you get into pipeline things, then you've got the PHMSA, the pipeline health safety, you know, federal organization, and now the Texas Public Utility Commission is involved in rates on that. In that aspect of the industry. And then, yeah, water law is primarily TCEQ, but, you know, financing stuff can go through the Water Development Board. There are things that the Water Development Board does that impact infrastructure and projects. And, you know, it's probably, oh, and then at an even more granular level, you've got a groundwater conservation district covering most of Texas has, you know, a groundwater conservation district covering and regulating production of groundwater in that geographic area. That can be one county big. It can be 2, 3, 4, you know, they vary in size and they're based on political boundaries, not hydrologic or geology boundaries of the aquifer. And so that gets interesting too. But yeah, there are certain, like everything in our world today, layers of regulation upon regulation that have to be dealt with and overcome.
I just don't know that I had a full appreciation for all the different layers and the complexity of your practice area. I've had limited exposure to it in my own practice. And, you know, it just seems to me to be a really complex, there's a lot of moving parts and there's a lot of tips or a lot of traps rather that one can fall into if they don't touch the bases in the right order.
Yeah. I mean, and that's where that network comes in. You know, knowing who, you know, I'm blessed to be in a law firm. I haven't got an update of how many lawyers we got, but, you know, 35 or so that are just oil and gas lawyers, you know, and that is within, or not just, I mean, some of them certainly do other things. So I don't mean to pigeonhole in anybody, but if I've got a, you know, a client who has an issue on a joint operating agreement, I've got somebody I can call on. I'm not going to give the client the advice on that. If it's a securities issue or whatever, you know, that's the niche specialties within the industry, you know, you are more than people realize for sure.
Well, one thing, you know, as we're kind of getting toward the end of our time, we wanted to ask you about that you'd mentioned in advance was mentoring and kind of the importance of mentoring. If you'd like to kind of talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, you mentioned that you had the benefit of mentors in your career, and we've talked about that some on our show in the past. Specifically, what I was curious about was, you know, mentoring you've mentioned was important to your development. Are you able to carry that forward and spend some time mentoring younger lawyers in your present situation?
Yeah, I do that as much as possible. Like professors at the law school at Tech, at A&M, and at Baylor, the oil and gas professors know that if they have a student come to them who's interested in pursuing a career in this area of the law, that I'm on their list of people that they can connect, right? And I do. I mean, I spend time talking to them on the phone if they're not local, or go grab breakfast or coffee. I think that's important, very important. And again, I would encourage any law student or young lawyer to not be afraid. Don't hesitate to reach out to people. If they don't have time, they'll tell you. Usually, hopefully they don't just leave you hanging. But, you know, I think they would be surprised at how often people, it's flattering to think that somebody wants your input, you know, is one thing people overlook. So I think people are more than willing to reach out. And yet in my career, I have been immensely blessed with great mentors. First jury trial I tried as lead counsel, a partner came, you know, it was 4 days and sat there with me and helped me guided me. I handled the whole thing, but you know, he was there and had a lot of advice along the way, and he didn't bill the client anything. Like that's what it takes, right? That's an extreme mm-hmm. example that people shouldn't get their hopes up for. But, you know, should have been me not billing the client and him billing the client, right? Because I'm the one getting the experience. But anyway, people like that I value tremendously. And hell, that was probably 13, 14 years ago. And I still lean on that guy. My first appeal was at the Fifth Circuit, and the lawyer who I was helping did them all the time and let me do it. I mean, when we got the appeal, he said, help me with this. And hey, if we get argument, you can argue it. He didn't think we were going to get argument, I'm sure, but, but we did. And so I was lucky to argue at the Fifth Circuit about 18 months after being licensed to practice. And, wow. You know, those kind of people, if you can find them, now I'm luckier than most, I think, in that regard, but find them, keep in touch with them, give them value too, you know, like, I mean, it needs mm-hmm. to be a two-way street. You can't be a parasite, but you think of things you can do for them and keep in touch with them and lean on them when you need to, even just to brainstorm. We talked about working remote earlier, and that's probably the only downside I see to working remote is not having three floors of lawyers to just walk the halls and see mm-hmm. somebody and say, hey, what do you think about this? You know, it takes more effort to pick up the phone and call somebody, and you don't know if they really have time for you because you can't see them.
Right.
But, you know, it's, I lean on other people a lot, and I try to return the favor anytime I can.
Well, you get the benefit of that contact with another human being, you know, mentioning working remotely. And we've all obviously been dealing with the pandemic for a year and a half, and things have kind of backslid a bit in terms of our ability to get out and resume normal life. But it seems like mentoring, either as a mentor or a mentee, is one opportunity to have those human touches that really mean a lot. Mm-hmm. And especially in times like we've been experiencing in the last year and a half. So, you know, thanks for what you do and trying to help Absolutely. Other people. I think Jody and I both agree 100% with what you said. It can make a big difference. We've been on the receiving end of it, and it's really a very good thing to do to be on the giving end of it and sort of pay it forward, as we say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. We benefit from having to think through things, you know, and
definitely.
Having a voice, you know, makes me reconsider some things sometimes if I have to give somebody advice. And be like, whoa, now that I really thought this through, I might have had a misconception about the, you know, nothing major, but, you know, it helps mm-hmm. us too, for sure.
Well, we've kind of reached our allotted time, but we always like to close by asking our guests for a tip or a war story. Anything you've got that you'd like to share?
Yeah, and I think y'all will like this. I don't have a lot of little war stories over the years, but the tip I would have is pretty early on, I was handling a trial, and the tip is read the rules of appellate procedure very carefully. They call them TRAPS for two reasons. One is that it's an acronym. The other is that it's an analogy. But yeah, I had a case where in the trial court, the judge went with me on something, and it was because I won procedurally, right? Or say technically, okay? The other side didn't comply with procedural rules that they had to win their side. So it was an easy, you know, he was clearly right in his decision. And the other side decided to mandamus him anyway, because it was a very important issue to them, and they felt like there was some equitable arguments they could make. I don't think they would have been successful in mandamusing him because it was clearly within his discretion. But, you know, and they would disagree with, you know, with what I just said also. And so they file their petition for writ of mandamus and go up, and that was in the fall, right, of the year. And in the spring, after they had filed it and it was still pending, the appellate specialist, big name, you know, or I say big name, I consider him to be, you know, a big name and a legend in Texas appellate practice, not just oil and gas. And he calls me and he says, because the trial counsel had farmed it out to an appellate specialist. Okay. And that's kind of the point here, is the benefit of having an appellate specialist. And he called me and he said, hey, so there's this little rule in the TRAPS that most people don't know about. And I hate to tell you this, but this has to go back to the trial court automatically. And I just need to see if you're going to be opposed to it, because you can't mandamus a new judge for what the old judge did. And your judge went off the bench and there's a new district judge effective January 1st. And I said, that can't be right. And looked it up and he was definitely right. And it had to go back. So the fact that I had won on a procedural snafu on their part that they were going to make damn sure was not repeated. You know, there was no point in even having the hearing again. So if that appellate lawyer had not had that experience and been that good at what he does, or if he had left it with the trial counsel, you know, if trial counsel had taken it up on their own, they wouldn't have known about that issue. And it had a significant impact on the case. And there, like I said, there was no point in teeing that hearing up again, because they weren't going to make that same mistake again. So essentially I lost the hearing after winning it. And so read the traps and call the appellate specialists, pay them for their time. You know, even if you want to continue handling it, you know, brainstorm with them. It's better to send it out completely, you know, most of the time. There's some benefit in you staying on because you know the facts. That can also be counterproductive because you're in the weeds. But on appeal, you know, what matters is what the record says, not how they said it or what your recollection is of how in the heat of the moment of a trial or a hearing, how it went and how you came across with what you thought was going on or things you heard that weren't actually said, you know, in the record. You need somebody to read it on paper, because that's what the appellate judges are going to do. And that's I encourage everybody to have a list of appellate lawyers you trust. Don't hesitate to call and, you know, and let them bill you, because it's worth advice.
I don't think you're going to hear any disagreement here.
Yeah. I promise this was not a paid advertisement.
They did not ask me for the record. They did not ask me to give that advice. That is my honest advice. I did know y'all would like that based on having listened to the podcast in the past, but yeah, it's true. It's all true.
Well, Wesley, thank you so much for spending time with us. It was very educational for me, and I hope it will be for our listeners too. So we appreciate you being with us.
Yeah, happy to. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.